This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Aptiv. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. New members get 50% off an annual membership, so please visit aptiv.com/cold. That's aptiv.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
November 27th, 1970, Ventura County, California. While representing Leslie Van Houten during the Manson family trial, 35-year-old attorney Ronald Hughes leaves to go on a camping trip. He never returns, and his decomposed body is found wedged between two boulders in a gorge 4 months later. While the actual cause of death could not be determined, Charles Manson had allegedly threatened Hughes, leading to speculation that he was an unconfirmed murder victim of the Manson family. After that, the trail went cold.
First of all, I believe it's very clear that Mr. Manson always has been denied counsel of his choice in this matter. Back in December, he was asking to have Mr. McKissick and Mr. Steinberg as his attorneys of record, and I would hope possibly to try and get them involved in this case, possibly even to substitute out and have them substitute in.
Is this your first case that you'll be trying?
Yeah, this will be the first case that I've ever tried.
How long have you been an attorney?
Just since last June.
Are you going to go ahead with the psychiatric examination?
No, we've withdrawn the psychiatric examination. I've seen Mr. Manson in county jail for probably more than any other attorney, 70, 80 times, and it's certainly my feeling that Mr. Manson is sane. There's no question about his sanity.
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the first Trail Went Cold episode of 2018. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and that sound clip you just heard was an interview with a defense attorney named Ronald Hughes, who will be the subject of today's episode. And yes, you heard him right. At the time, he was representing none other than Charles Manson, and the very case Hughes ever tried in court was the Manson family murders. Also, that voice you just heard narrate our opening was our latest contest winner, Andrew Dodge. Last year, we started a recurring monthly contest where our listeners can earn a chance to recite the opening narration for one of our podcast episodes. Andrew won our monthly drawing last month and did an amazing job, so a big thanks to him. If you haven't already entered this contest, I will be sharing more details about how you can do so at the end of this episode. Anyway, as I'm sure you probably know, the notorious Charles Manson passed away less than 2 months ago at the age of 83. There are numerous podcasts out there which have done episodes about the Manson family, but this particular episode is not going to be about them. Instead, it's going to focus on Ronald Hughes and the possibility of whether or not he was one of the Manson family's unconfirmed victims. Hughes was originally appointed to be Charles Manson's defense attorney at the Tate-LaBianca murder trial, though he eventually wound up representing one of Manson's followers, Leslie Van Houten. Before the trial ended, Hughes went missing and would later turn up dead under unexplained circumstances. It's possible that Hughes's death was nothing more than a tragic accident, but some believe that Manson's loyal followers might have had him killed. It's also worth mentioning that Leslie Van Houten was recommended for parole a few months before this was recorded, and it's currently still up in the air about whether or not she is going to be released from prison, so this seems like an ideal time to examine this story. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off the new year by exploring the unsolved death of Ronald Hughes.
Bow, 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 bow
Our story begins in California in 1970. Our central figure is 35-year-old Ronald Hughes, an aspiring attorney who would soon find himself embroiled in one of the most sensational murder trials of all time. Hughes was born in Los Angeles, but spent much of his youth in New York City, and after serving in the Army during the Korean War and graduating from Queens College, he later moved back to California to attend UCLA School of Law. His attempt at a legal career took a little while to get going, as he failed the bar exam on three separate occasions, but after finally passing on his fourth attempt in June of 1969, Hughes got a job as a law clerk with the Public Defender's Office. Even though Hughes hailed from a conservative family, he had developed a vast interest in the hippie subculture and grown a bushy Santa Claus-style beard, which helped earn him the nickname the Hippie Lawyer. And this was one of the main reasons why Hughes became a candidate to represent a man who was becoming one of the most notorious criminals of all time, Charles Manson. Now, I'm sure I don't have to provide much backstory about this guy and his cult of followers from the Manson family, but here's a rundown of the crimes they were charged with. In December of 1969, Manson and four of his followers, Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian, were indicted for a series of brutal murders which took place earlier that year at a Benedict Canyon home owned by actress Sharon Tate. Shortly after midnight on August 9th, Manson directed his followers to enter the estate and break into the house, where they proceeded to murder five victims: Sharon Tate, Wojtek Frykowski, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, and Stephen Parent. The Manson family would also be indicted for a pair of home invasion murders which took place in the Los Feliz section of Los Angeles the very next evening, where they entered the home of supermarket executive Lino LaBianca and proceeded to murder both him and his wife, Rosemary LaBianca. This time, they were accompanied by a 19-year-old follower named Leslie Van Houten, who would also be indicted for her role in the LaBianca murders. Anyway, Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten would all go on trial together for all seven murders. Tex Watson was admitted to a state hospital to evaluate whether he was fit to stand trial. While she was present at both murder scenes, Linda Kasabian did not physically participate in any of the killings, so she was offered immunity for her testimony against the four Manson family defendants. Manson's initial inclination was to act as his own attorney and represent himself at trial, which would have been a disaster of epic proportions. So he was assigned a court-appointed defense attorney who wanted his client to undergo a psychiatric examination. Well, Manson promptly fired his attorney for this and selected Ronald Hughes, since the two of them had become acquainted when Hughes visited Manson in county jail. But of course, Hughes had never actually tried a case before, and now he would be right in the middle of a media circus. However, 2 weeks before the start of the trial, Hughes was replaced as Manson's counsel by Irvin Kinnerick, a veteran defense attorney with a reputation for obstructionist tactics. Instead, Hughes would be appointed to represent Leslie Van Houten. Before Hughes became her lawyer, Van Houten had already dismissed three other attorneys for attempting to put up the defense that she only participated in the murders because Manson had full control over her. In spite of this, Hughes would utilize this very same strategy at the trial, which began in June of 1970. Needless to say, Hughes was a very unlikely choice to be a defense attorney at a trial of this magnitude, as he had no office, very little money, and slept on a mattress on the floor of a garage at a friend's house, with a framed copy of his bar certificate hanging on the wall. He would often show up to court dressed in clothing that didn't match and had noticeable food stains. In fact, many of Hughes' suits were purchased on the cheap at a sale from the props department at MGM Studios. During the trial, Hughes showed his inexperience, as he often arrived late and made frequent procedural errors. At one point, the trial judge, Charles Older, held Hughes in contempt of court for openly saying that a statement prosecuting attorney Vincent Bugliosi had made was, quote-unquote, a lot of shit. Hughes was given the choice between paying a $75 fine and spending the night in jail, but since he cannot afford $75, he responded, "I am a pauper, Your Honor," and spent the night in jail. But there were moments during the trial when Hughes proved to be surprisingly effective, and his knowledge of the hippie lifestyle served him well during his cross-examination of Linda Kasabian. He questioned Kasabian about her use of hallucinogenic drugs and got her to admit on the stand that she believed she was a witch, believed in ESP, and felt she was being controlled by Manson's quote-unquote vibrations, which didn't exactly help her credibility as a witness. From the outset, Manson always hoped that his three female co-defendants would take full responsibility for committing all the murders, and that he could convince the jury he had nothing to do with them and secure an acquittal. Needless to say, Manson was none too happy that Hughes was attempting to put up the best possible defense for Leslie Van Houten, and did not seem content to let his client take the fall. On November 16th, the prosecution rested their case, but the defense stunned everyone 3 days later by announcing that they also rested, even though they had not presented any case of their own. Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten all responded by standing up in the courtroom and shouting that they wanted to testify and tell everyone that they committed all the murders of their own free will and that Manson had nothing to do with it. While the main reason the defense had rested their case was to prevent the female defendants from testifying and incriminating themselves, and Ronald Hughes openly stated, "I refuse to take part in any proceeding where I am forced to push a client out the window." The following day, Manson decided to make a long statement to the court and ultimately told his three female co-defendants that they wouldn't have to testify. Since the Thanksgiving holidays were approaching, Judge Older granted a 10-day recess for both the prosecution and the defense to prepare their closing arguments. Before Hughes and Manson went their separate ways, the last thing Manson allegedly said to him was, "I don't want to see you in the courtroom again." When speaking to reporters afterward, Hughes stated that he was confident he would be able to secure an acquittal for Leslie Van Houten. On November 27th, the day after Thanksgiving, Hughes decided he wanted to spend the weekend going on a camping trip, and he asked two 17-year-old neighbor friends of his, James Forsher and Lauren Elder, to join him. At the time, Hughes had recently received a number of traffic tickets over damage to his own car, so he could not legally drive it until repairs were done, but Elder agreed to give him a ride in her Volkswagen. The trio decided to travel 2 hours north of Los Angeles to a remote area in Ventura County near the town of Ojai and went camping in the rugged Sespe Hot Springs area of Los Padres National Forest. However, the area was soon hit with a massive rainstorm. On the morning of November 28th, Forsher and Elder decided to return to Los Angeles, but Hughes wanted to remain behind in order to work on his closing arguments. So the two teens left Hughes and attempted to leave in their Volkswagen, but when they discovered that the vehicle was stuck in the mud, Forsher and Elder decided to hitchhike their way back home. Shortly after they left, Hughes was seen by three campers and had a brief conversation with them, but this would turn out to be the last time he would be seen alive. As the weekend went on, the torrential rainstorms only worsened and caused some flash floods which led to the wilderness area being evacuated. Anyway, the Manson family trial finally reconvened on Monday, November 30th, but Hughes failed to show up in court that day. It seemed likely that Hughes had not returned home from the camping trip and was still in Ventura County somewhere, but since the torrential rainstorms were still going strong, it would be another 2 days before an official search of the Sespe Hot Springs area could be launched. Lauren Elder's Volkswagen was eventually discovered in the mud, and while some court transcripts were still inside the vehicle, some of Hughes' other papers, including a psychiatric report on Leslie Van Houten, were missing. But even though ground and air searches were performed of the wilderness area, no trace of Hughes was found. James Forsher, Lauren Elder, and the three campers who last saw Hughes were each questioned and polygraphed by police, who concluded they were all telling the truth and had no knowledge about what happened to him. After a 2-day delay, Judge Older decided that the trial needed to proceed, so he appointed a new attorney named Maxwell Keith to take Hughes' place and represent Leslie Van Houten. While this caused quite a stir among the three female defendants, who demanded that all of their lawyers be fired, but the request was denied. The defendants then went so far as to accuse Judge Older of doing away with Hughes, and Manson even threw a paperclip at him. Hughes continued to remain a missing person, but in March of 1971, the police received an anonymous tip suggesting they search the area surrounding the Barker Ranch in Inyo County. Of course, the Barker Ranch was where the Manson family was living prior to their arrests. The anonymous informant claimed that Manson's loyal followers had murdered Hughes and buried his body there, but a search of the area turned up nothing. Finally, on the morning of March 29th, there would be some answers when two fishermen discovered a severely decomposed male body wedged between two boulders in a gorge in Ventura County, approximately 7 miles from where Hughes was last seen. The body was unclothed, had been eaten away by animals, and his entire right arm was missing. Dental records soon positively identified the victim as Ronald Hughes, but due to the state of decomposition, no one could figure out the exact cause of death, so it was officially ruled as undetermined. While Hughes was missing, the trial continued, and on January 25th, the jury found Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten guilty on the charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. And in an ironic turn of events, they would all receive death sentences on March 29th, the very same day Hughes' body was found, though their sentences were reduced to life imprisonment after the California Supreme Court abolished the death penalty the following year. Tex Watson would eventually be convicted of murder and conspiracy to commit murder at his own trial in October of 1971, and he is still incarcerated today at the age of 72. As you well know, Charles Manson died in November of 2017, while Susan Atkins died in prison in September of 2009 at the age of 61, and Patricia Krenwinkel remains incarcerated today at age 70. But the death of Ronald Hughes would cause some complications with Leslie Van Houten's life sentence. Her new defense attorneys argued that a mistrial should have been declared when Hughes turned up missing right before closing arguments. They felt Van Houten deserved a new trial on the grounds that she was denied proper legal representation. The appellate court agreed with this, so Van Houten received a new trial in 1977, which ended in a hung jury. But at her third trial the following year, Van Houten was once again convicted on 2 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder, and received a sentence of 7 years to life in prison. Well, over the course of the next 4 decades, she was denied parole 19 times. Van Houten did finally receive a recommendation for parole in 2016, but it was denied by California Governor Jerry Brown. Like I mentioned in the intro, Van Houten, who is currently 68 years old, received a second recommendation for parole in September of 2017, and as of this recording, they are still awaiting the approval of Governor Brown to determine if she'll be set free. As for Ronald Hughes, there has been a lot of debate about the circumstances of his death. The Ventura County Sheriff who investigated Hughes' case did not see any noticeable signs of foul play on his body and believed his death was accidental. He figured that the massive rainstorm caused the creek to swell, which led to Hughes either drowning or being swept away by the water and being killed by rocks and debris. However, there are others who disagree, one of whom is Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecuting attorney at the Manson family's trial. Of course, Bugliosi went on to co-write Helter Skelter, one of the most famous true crime books of all time, and he did not hesitate to outline his suspicions about Hughes' death. When Bugliosi saw the original autopsy report, he was unsatisfied with the ruling that Hughes' death was undetermined, and asked his office to conduct a further investigation, but they were denied. Like many people, Bugliosi always believed the Manson family were responsible for many more murders than they were officially linked to. During the making of a documentary about the Manson family, a follower named Sandra Good reportedly told the filmmakers that in total, the group had killed between 35 to 40 people, and that Ronald Hughes was the first of the quote-unquote retaliation murders. In 1976, Bugliosi himself received an anonymous phone call from someone claiming to be a former member of the Manson family who told him that Hughes had definitely been murdered. Given Manson's final cryptic statement to Hughes about not wanting to see him in the courtroom again, there has always been speculation that Hughes was murdered in retaliation for his decision to stand up to Manson, as he would not just sit back and allow Leslie Van Houten to take the fall for the murders. But there has never been any hard evidence to incriminate the Manson family, and the official cause of Ronald Hughes' death remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold.
This episode of The Trail Went Cold is brought to you by Aptiv, as we are very excited that they are supporting the show. Aptiv produces audio-based workouts created by certified personal trainers available through a mobile app. Aptiv makes the highest quality training available to everyone with a carefully selected group of certified personal trainers that guide you through every workout. The trainers have a wide array of personalities, so you can even find the personal training styling that motivates you best. Plus, Aptiv's in-house music production team partners with every trainer to create music playlists that are perfectly timed to the intensity and pace of your workout. When you need that extra boost, the music keeps you going and motivated. When you're ready to slow things down, the intensity of the music dials down with you. Whenever or wherever you like to work out, at the gym, at home, outside, when you're traveling for business, Aptiv is ready to go along with you with their mobile app. It's like having a personal trainer in your pocket. Whether you're interested in running, strength training, indoor cycling, stair climbing, yoga, or even meditation, Aptiv trainers give you the guidance you need to be better at the types of exercises you love, delivered in a flexible audio format to make fitness a lasting part of your routine. Aptiv has classes for all fitness levels, from beginner to intermediate to advanced. And with more than 2,500 workouts available on the platform and over 30 new classes added each week, there's always a new workout to try. Or simply pick the type of guidance you are feeling up for that day, whether it's technical training, high-energy coaching, or bootcamp-style intensity. One of the best features of Aptiv is the ability to search by difficulty, music genre, and duration, so you can find a workout you love every time. As you might have guessed, being a podcaster is not a job which lends itself to a lot of physical activity, as you spend the majority of your time plopped down in front of a computer or a microphone. So in order to keep myself in good shape, I was very grateful to receive a free trial with Aptiv. Instead of having to take the time to travel to a gym somewhere, it was very convenient to work out with Aptiv's mobile app, which provides a flexible audio workout format that allows me to work out just the way I like without even having to leave my own home. That certainly saves me a lot of much-needed time. Subscriptions start at $9.99 billed monthly, or $99.99 for an annual membership. For a limited time, new members get 50% off an annual membership, which is just $49.99 for the whole year of unlimited workouts. So to take advantage of this offer, visit aptiv.com/cold. That's aaptiv.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of our episode. So yes, the whole saga of the Manson family is one of the biggest true crime stories ever, and contains a number of colorful characters, but I gotta say, before I started researching this episode, I didn't know all that much about Ronald Hughes. All I knew was that he was a defense attorney who went missing and was found dead during the trial, but now that I've delved into Hughes' backstory, I find him to be a very fascinating individual. To say the least, he was not a guy you'd expect to be involved in one of the biggest murder trials in history. Let's make a comparison between two sensational trials. You have O.J. Simpson, who hires the most skilled, high-priced defense attorneys money can buy in order to represent him. And then there's the Manson family, who hire an attorney who sleeps on a mattress in his friend's garage. Ronald Hughes actually sounds like he could be a protagonist in a John Grisham novel. A poverty-stricken, underdog lawyer who winds up taking on one of the biggest cases ever for his very first trial and performs much better than expected in the courtroom. The whole thing would almost seem inspirational if the defendants weren't, you know, the Manson family. But you gotta give the guy a lot of credit. Even though he was not the most graceful attorney in the world and made his fair share of mistakes, everyone thought Hughes did remarkably well for his first trial, considering all the notoriety and media attention which surrounded it. When you read Helter Skelter, it's clear that Vincent Bugliosi had a lot of respect and affection for Hughes. After Hughes was held in contempt of court for stating that Bugliosi's statements were, quote-unquote, a lot of shit, Hughes went up to him to apologize. When Bugliosi told him not to worry about it, Hughes stated, "Oh, I'm not apologizing for that," and then proceeded to apologize for having suggested the obstructionist Irvin Kenarik as his replacement as Manson's attorney. Hughes might have gone on to have a fairly successful legal career, though shortly before his death, he did state in an interview that he was thinking of quitting law in order to become a character actor. Now, say what you will about Leslie Van Houten and her culpability in the LaBianca murders, Hughes did what any ethical defense attorney is supposed to do and represented his client the best he could. You can debate Hughes' claims about whether or not Manson actually had full control over Van Houten, but regardless,
he was not going to just throw his client to the wolves and follow Manson's strategy of letting the three female defendants take the fall in order to increase Manson's chances of potentially walking free. I'm sure it must have been intimidating to stand up to Manson like that, especially when you know he had so many rabid followers out there who would cater to his every whim. Hughes did confide in his friends that he was afraid of Manson, but even so, he did not back down from his duty to provide his client with the best possible defense. But I suppose the big question here is, did this decision cost Hughes his life? Well, even though Hughes' cause of death cannot be determined, law enforcement always leaned towards the idea that there was no foul play involved, and his death was nothing more than a tragic accident. And under normal circumstances, there probably wouldn't be any reason to question this. If a guy goes missing while camping in an area which is hit by torrential rainstorms and flash floods, that wouldn't seem particularly suspicious. But when he does so right after pissing off Charles Manson, that's a different story. It seems like the biggest supporter of the foul play theory in this case is Vincent Bugliosi. Up until his death in 2015, Bugliosi was still expressing his belief during interviews that Hughes was murdered by members of the Manson family. In Helter Skelter, he delved into a potential theory surrounding Hughes' death, and it's convoluted, so bear with me here for a moment. On December 2, 1970, two fugitives from the Manson family, Bruce Davis and Nancy Pittman, voluntarily turned themselves into police. Now, these were two of the most hardcore, devoutly loyal members of the family, so it surprised a lot of people that they surrendered so peacefully, but apparently they did so on Manson's orders. Davis was described as Manson's right-hand man and was involved in the murders of two other Manson family victims, Gary Hinman and Donald Shorty Shea. He was convicted on two counts of first-degree murder and is still incarcerated today. Nancy Pittman, who sometimes went by the name Brenda McCann, was only wanted on a forgery charge at this time, but she was nicknamed the chief assassin of the Manson family. During the trial, Manson told Bugliosi, quote, "If I had all the power and control that you say I have, I could simply say, Brenda, go get Bugliosi, and that would be it." End quote. Anyway, the point is that some people found the timing very odd that Manson would order Davis and Pittman to surrender only a few days after Ronald Hughes disappeared, and on the very same day a new attorney was appointed for Leslie Van Houten. The crux of Bugliosi's big theory involved Hughes' two companions on his camping trip, James Forsher and Lauren Elder. After they were questioned by police, Forsher and Elder completely dropped off the radar, and their whereabouts were unknown at the time Helter Skelter was written. Due to the fact that their first names were the same, Bugliosi wondered if perhaps Forsher and Elder might be a couple named James and Lauren Willett, who were both murdered in Stockton in November of 1972. James's body was found in a shallow grave in the desert, while Lauren's body was buried in the basement of a house. She had a gunshot wound to her head, though her housemates claimed that Lauren had accidentally killed herself while playing Russian roulette. Anyway, these housemates just happened to be members of the Manson family, and they would be indicted for their roles in the Willetts' murders. One of them was Nancy Pittman, who was convicted of being an accessory after the fact and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Bugliosi speculated that if James Forsher and Lauren Elder were in fact James and Lauren Willett, then perhaps they were murdered by the Manson family because they knew too much about Ronald Hughes' death. Well, as intriguing as this theory sounded, it was completely debunked when Forsher resurfaced in 1979 and actually went so far as to sue Bugliosi for libel and invasion of privacy because of his theory in Helter Skelter. Forsher denied having any involvement in Hughes' death or any connection to the Manson family, and believed the book was falsely accusing him of being complicit in a murder. Well, Forsher wound up losing the lawsuit because Bugliosi had only speculated about a potential theory and never flat-out accused Forsher of anything. Anyway, I'm not sure if they ever found out what happened to Lauren Elder. Given that Lauren Willett was 19 years old when she was killed, the age would have matched up, but since Lauren Willett's maiden name was Olmsted, it's very unlikely that she was Lauren Elder. Strangely enough, there was another Lauren Elder from California who became somewhat famous after surviving an airplane crash in the Sierra Nevada in 1976 and wrote a best-selling book about the experience, but she's definitely not the same person. Overall, in spite of what Bugliosi might have thought, Law enforcement was always satisfied that Forsher and Elder were telling the truth about their camping trip with Hughes. Now, I have to admit, I've always found certain things about the whole trip to be quite odd. Most especially how a 35-year-old man like Hughes would be out camping with two 17-year-olds. But I guess since virtually every aspect of Ronald Hughes' life was a bit odd, I guess I shouldn't read too much into it. Hughes probably just really wanted to go camping that weekend, but since his own vehicle needed repairs, and his two neighbor friends had their own transportation, he decided to invite them along so he could hitch a ride. Of course, after the area was hit by a torrential rainstorm, and Forsher and Elder wanted to head back to Los Angeles, I have no idea why Hughes decided he wanted to stay out there, and I'm not exactly sure how he was planning to get home after they left. Camping out in a rainstorm does not seem like the ideal conditions in order to work on closing statements in a major trial, but then again, Hughes lived in a garage, so maybe he just preferred doing his legal work in the wilderness, regardless of the weather. It also seems strange that Forsher and Elder would just leave their Volkswagen stuck in the mud all weekend and hitchhike home rather than call for help to get their vehicle towed out, but maybe they just wanted to get out of the rain and would make arrangements to retrieve the Volkswagen after the rain stopped. But in spite of these oddities, that doesn't change the fact that three other witnesses spoke with Hughes in the woods after Forsher and Elder had already left, and they claimed that everything was fine. Forsher, Elder, and these three witnesses were all questioned and polygraphed by police, and as far as they were concerned, their stories checked out. Since Bugliosi's original theory about Forsher and Elder was debunked, I really see no reason to believe they were involved in what happened to Hughes, or that they had any affiliation with the Manson family at all. Now obviously, the big issue with believing that Manson family members such as Bruce Davis or Nancy Pittman murdered Hughes is the fact that he was over 100 miles away from his home in the middle of the woods, meaning that if Forsher and Elder were not involved, then the only way anyone could have found Hughes there was if they followed him all the way from Los Angeles. We know that Hughes arrived on November 27th, but he was last seen alive on the 28th, which would mean that whoever killed him laid in wait for an entire night, even though the weather had gotten considerably worse by that point. Killing someone outdoors in the middle of a torrential rainstorm sounds like a pretty big challenge. I suppose a possible explanation for that is that the perpetrators thought it might be easier to kill Hughes while he was alone, so they just waited for his two companions to leave, but then, how could they have predicted Forsher and Elder would leave in the first place? And of course, if this was the Manson family, these are people who had no hesitation about breaking into someone's house and murdering multiple people. So I doubt the presence of two extra teenagers would hold them back, and they consider them to be nothing more than collateral damage. Not only that, but if this was a murder, what sheer luck for them that a flash flood would hit the area and wash Hughes' body so far away that it wasn't found for months, and by then, there were no longer any noticeable signs of foul play. The more you think about how these events unfolded, the less likely it seems that Hughes was murdered. Admittedly, there are a few things which do bother me. The three campers who last saw Hughes on the morning of November 28th claimed that he was on high ground in an area which was a great distance away from the floodwaters. But then, we don't know the exact time Hughes was killed that weekend, so who's to say the flooding didn't eventually reach that point, or that Hughes simply traveled to another location where he got caught up in the water and either drowned or was killed while being swept away. The strangest thing to me is that when Hughes' body was found 4 months later, it was unclothed. I'm not sure if a flash flood can knock a victim's clothing off, but for all we know, maybe Hughes was already naked at the time he was swept away, or his clothing was just torn away by the animals which had been feeding on his body. But overall, if you were to make a chart comparing the points for and against foul play in this case, I really don't think there are going to be a lot of check marks in the for column. Obviously, the main reason people suspect Hughes was murdered was because his last official act as an attorney was pissing off Charles Manson, who allegedly told him, "I don't want to see you in this courtroom again." So it's tempting to believe that Manson ordered his followers to dispose of Hughes before he had a chance to return to court and deliver a closing argument which painted him in a bad light, but by the time Hughes left on his camping trip, the trial had already been recessed for a week, so the Manson family had plenty of other opportunities to go after Hughes before he traveled over 100 miles outside Los Angeles. Remember, the guy lived in a garage, so it probably wouldn't have been too difficult to get to him. While the main proponent of the Hughes was murder theory is Vincent Bugliosi, he only has two sources to support it, and neither of them are particularly reliable. One was an anonymous phone call which took place over 4 years after the fact, and the other was a couple of off-the-record statements from Sandra Good. In case you're not aware of her background, Good was always making wild claims that the Manson family was going to be assassinating people. In 1975, one of her friends, Lynette Fromm, made a failed attempt to assassinate President Gerald Ford, and Good started making threats that a quote-unquote wave of assassins from a group she called the People's Court of Retribution were going to kill and disfigure many corporate executives and their families in retaliation for their pollution of the earth. Well, none of these assassinations ever took place, but Good wound up receiving a 15-year prison sentence for conspiracy to send threatening letters through the mail. But the point is, if Sandra Good was claiming that Ronald Hughes' death was the first of the Manson family's quote-unquote retaliation murders, I'd take that with a huge grain of salt. Now, I have very little doubt that the Manson family was likely responsible for a number of other unsolved murders which they were never officially connected to, but I just don't think Ronald Hughes was one of them. I think Hughes' death was nothing more than a tragic accident caused by the forces of nature, and it's just a massive coincidence that it happened to take place right after he angered one of the most infamous criminals ever during one of the biggest murder trials in history. Is it completely impossible that Hughes was murdered by the Manson family? No, but I just find it very unlikely, and other than a few statements from unreliable sources, there's just no evidence to suggest they were responsible. Remember, the Manson family was not exactly known for their ability to keep their mouths shut, and one of the main reasons they wound up getting indicted in the Tate-LaBianca murders is because Susan Atkins could not stop talking about the crimes in jail. In other words, if the Manson family members did murder Hughes, I think there probably would have been a lot more talk about it, other than a handful of statements over the course of a few years. But I think we've now said more than enough about these pricks. When Charles Manson died in November, I saw a lot of people on social media make an excellent point. We should not use this moment to remember this evil man or his evil followers. Instead, they posted up photos of their victims and said we should use this moment to remember their names. Sharon Tate, Wojtek Frykowski, Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Stephen Parent, Lena LaBianca, Rosemary LaBianca, Gary Hinman, Shorty Shea, James Willett, Lauren Willett, and some others we probably don't even know about. Now, even though I do not actually believe he was a Manson family murder victim, I think the same logic applies to Ronald Hughes. The guy was a very interesting character who may not have had the ideal client, but clearly understood the ethics of his profession and the importance of giving her the best defense possible. If Hughes was not murdered, and his death was just a tragic accident, it is a shame that it had to occur during such a sensational murder trial, since his name will forever be associated with conspiracy theories surrounding the Manson family. Even though Hughes wasn't sure he wanted to remain in the legal field, it would have been interesting to see where his life might have gone if he had lived. All that being said, his cause of death is still officially listed as undetermined, so if by chance you happen to have any hard information about the death of Ronald Hughes or evidence that he was a victim of foul play, please contact the appropriate authorities. As we bring this episode to a close, I want to send out another special thanks to Andrew Dodge for a stellar job at reciting this year's very first guest listener opening narration. Like I mentioned in the intro, this is a recurring monthly contest for our listeners to win the opportunity to do the same thing. If you've already entered this contest before, you are already eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter the contest and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trailwind Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send an email under the subject line, Trailwind Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board, the Sitcoms Online Forum. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode.
And since we've entered a new month, and a new year for that matter, this is a good time to thank our recurring monthly donors, and they are Don, Amber, Brian, Casey, Ellie, Kathleen, Keisha, Laura, Megan, Clinton, Lewis, Jennifer, and Aura. So thank you very much, guys. Your generosity is greatly appreciated.
If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself or your fellow listeners, feel free to join, and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So I hope you enjoyed our very first episode of 2018, and we think this is going to be another amazing year for the podcast. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.